Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome everybody to the second day. Some people are still not here, but I think we should start because we are 5 minutes. So I just have a little announcement that we have exchanged the talks of Giovanni Merlo and Philip Goff, so that Philip Goff can speak in the morning. It's easier for him. So the second talk will be Philip Goff instead of Giovanni, and Giovanni will be in the afternoon. Okay, so we have the pleasure of welcoming Katalin Farkas from the Central European University for this first talk. She's going to talk about varieties of privileged access.
Thank you, Gregory. It's lovely to be here, and I really enjoyed the first day of talks. As it says on the bottle, I will talk about varieties of privileged access. Let me start with making a few remarks that some of you may debate, but I think they are fairly common ground among a lot of people who think about self-knowledge or introspection or knowledge of our own mental states. So I think that claims about our own mental features are not infallible. We can certainly make mistakes on virtually every kind of attribution of mental features. And there is no such thing as omniscience, that is that we are in a position to know all our mental features, or what is sometimes called luminosity, that if there is a mental feature that we have, then we will come to know, believe that we have that feature. So it doesn't have this kind of epistemically privileged or epistemically valuable features, but nonetheless, I think a lot of people feel that a default epistemic priority over other people's claims, when I make claims about our own mental features, is something that we have. And this is what is called, what I will call, first-person authorities. That's all I mean, a default priority over other people's claims when we make claims about our own mental states, our own mental features. Now, I can't aim at a complete list of all the accounts of first-person privilege, but I will list a few that are important for my purposes. This is, I think it's the beginning of an account of privileged access to our conscious mental features, is to note that we are the only people who are conscious of our own mental features. This has been sometimes debated by, designing cases of Siamese twins who are connected together, but I don't think any of these examples work. I really think that this is categorically true, that I am the only person who is conscious of my own conscious features. So consciousness cannot be shared by two subjects. One subject, one consciousness. And that is at least the beginning of an account of privileged access, because if I am the only one who is conscious of these features, then through this fact that I'm conscious of it, I may get an explanation of why I have a default epistemic priority. Sometimes I think that that's enough to say, but a lot of people feel that that's not enough. You have to say something more. Why, just me being the only person who is conscious of my mental features, explains this epistemic priority? And then, for example, there are theories which posit something which is called acquaintance, which is a direct awareness of conscious features. And then there are various stories about how this will provide the first-person authority over precisely these features. So it's important to know that this applies to all, but only conscious features. So that part of the mind which is not included in our conscious episodes is not covered by acquaintance theories. What are those parts which are not covered by conscious episodes? Well, sort of what are sometimes called standing states, beliefs and desires and intentions, the kind of states that I don't lose overnight, my belief that Paris is in France, my desire to have ice cream in the afternoon, etc. So what we could call simple transparency theories cover not only conscious episodes, but I think they are supposed to be covering also attitudes, these standing attitudes. Somewhat confusingly, this is also called transparency. I mean, I've been learning German since we moved to Vienna, and one of my objections to the German language is that, one of my many objections to the German language is that they are reusing the same word, right? So like ihr means her, and then you, and then his or her in the formal, and it also it's the dative of, I mean, you know, couldn't you find another three-letter word? I mean, I have ideas like or something, but no, they reuse the same word. And philosophy is a bit like this, and, you know, like four different kinds of things which are called transparency. So this could be called e-transparency, maybe after Gareth Evans, who was always credited with suggesting this idea first. The idea here is that if you want to find out what you believe, whether you believe that P, you just simply look at the question of P. So you don't have to look inwards or introspect or make use of a special faculty like acquaintance or anything like that. But when you want to find out whether you believe that there will be a third world war, you just consider the question of whether there will be a third world war. And so Alex Byrne has a book about this and he works out the details of this account. He says that there is this rule that if P believe that you believe that P, and then throughout the book he works out versions of this theory for other kinds of mental states. Now, I think it's very interesting. That work is very interesting. I think it's much less convincing for other types of mental features. With beliefs, it is very convincing. He has for pains, for emotions, for desires, sensations, I think that doesn't work so well. And there is a rather different account, which is most influentially defended by Richard Moran, also makes use of the e-transparency phenomenon, but works it out in a different way, and sometimes these accounts are called agential accounts. So, Moran distinguishes between two ways in which we can relate to our mental features. What first he calls a theoretical or empirical perspective. This is the same for the first person and the third person. This is when, if you like, I treat myself like my therapist would treat me. I try to find out about my mental states or mental features by treating myself as the object of psychological inquiry. So Moran thinks that when we are trying to find out about our mental features in this way, then this is a predicament of estrangement. We are not fully unified as an agent because we are treating ourselves from this third-person point of view in the way that we might treat other people when we try to find out about their mental states. And he contrasts this with what he calls the deliberative stance. And he says, I treat the question, what do I believe, as having the same answer as, what am I to believe? What do I have reason to believe? Reflecting on the reasons for believing that P, I can commit to P and to the belief that P at the same time. This is a form of rational self-construction or reconstruction, Moran says. And this works only in the first person. Why? Because only I can make this commitment for myself that I will believe whatever I have most reason to believe. I can't commit Gregory to this. I mean, I can recommend him to do this, or I can hope that he would do this, but I can't make a commitment on his behalf that he will believe what he has most reason to believe. So this commitment singles out the first person, and Moran thinks that it's when we occupy this deliberative sense is when we are truly united with our agency when we have true first-person authority. Just a remark that I think Moran's account also meant to apply both to conscious episodes and to standing states, so this is a more general theory. There is an interesting sort of response or comment on this by Kasim Kassam, for example, in a book that was published in 2014 called Self-Knowledge for Humans. And Crystal Orlo has two papers where she defends a very similar account. So basically, one thing that Kassam considers very important is that he's interested in the difficult cases of self-knowledge. He points out when he starts the book that philosophers often use examples like, I believe that water is wet, or I believe that it's raining, or his example is, I believe that I'm wearing socks. And then they ask the question, how do I know that I believe that water is wet? How do I know that I believe that I'm wearing socks? And Kassam correctly says that this is really a question that is of interest only to a philosopher. It's, self-knowledge is a very important topic. It's very important to know our own mind. But in real life, this thing doesn't have any stakes, right, to find out what I, of course I do. So that kind of approach does not address difficult questions. He says, I'm trying to find out whether I believe that eating meat is wrong, or whether I want to move to another country, whether I want to be a philosopher, or whether I'm a racist. These are the kind of difficult but important questions about getting to know ourselves. And this is that, it's true that, like Alex Byrne, he mentions examples like, I know that it's raining, I know that I believe that it's raining, etc. So Kassam and Laura is the same. She's also interested in finding out the answers to difficult questions. And they both think that Moran's account is that gets things wrong. It assumes too much rationality about human beings because of this general commitment that we will believe what we have most reason to believe, or we desire that what we have most reason to desire. I mean, human beings are really not like that. So what of those who don't follow this rule of rationality to that extent? So what they endorse is more like Moran's empirical perspective. They think that we find out about our attitudes through inferring from our actions and internal reactions. So this is like Ryle suggests it's a kind of behaviorist account of self-knowledge. It goes beyond Ryle, importantly, because they don't just look at outward action, but a very important data for this self-interpretation or self-knowledge is our thoughts and feelings, the way that we respond to certain kind of situations. Kassam says that his theory does not provide a first-person privilege because it's the same method for first-person and third-person. It's inferential knowledge from the consequences holding various attitudes, but I think it does have a certain amount of privileged access. I have privilege because I have data for my inferences that is available only to me because a lot of the data comes from features of consciousness. Now an in principle one, because I could go very, very exhaustive therapy sessions and report to my therapist every single thing that goes through my mind and describe all my feelings in great detail. But I think that still doesn't quite capture the way that this data, which we have as a starting point for inference, is given to me. I think I can also, there is something like I can manipulate my, as we shall see in an example in a moment, I can manipulate my inner reactions And I'm aware of them in a way that no one else is. So I do think that despite of what Kassam says, there is a certain amount of first-person privilege even in this picture. Okay, there is something like acquaintance, or sometimes people talk about inner mechanism, and that applies only to conscious features. There is something like the simple transparency observation where I can just easily move from the question of whether I believe that water is wet to whether water is wet. There's the agential account where I occupy the deliberative stance and I see what I have reason to believe or want. And then there is the empirical stance where I treat myself as the object of psychological inquiry, but help myself to the rich data that's coming from my conscious reflections. So, who is right? Clearly, Kassam and Lola take themselves to be disagreeing with Moran. Byrne extensively criticizes both Moran and acquaintance theorists. The extended Rileyans don't have much time for the transparency observation at all. So I think that everyone is right. After thinking some time about this subject, I think everyone is right. I think that everyone is right, at least about some aspect of self-knowledge. And I'm going to illustrate this on a case that comes from a paper by Crystal Lawler. And it is used by her and by Kassam to criticize Moran. Okay, so this is the case. It's about a woman called Catherine who wants to find out whether she wants to have another child. The whole thing starts by she's standing by her first child's crib, and then suddenly the thought pops into her head, have another one. So that prompts the question in her, do I want to have another child? So how will Catherine find out? Now that the question has been called, Catherine starts noticing her experiences and thoughts. She catches herself imagining, remembering, and feeling a range of things. Putting away her son's now too small clothes, she finds herself lingering over the memory of how a newborn feels in one's arms. She notes an emotion that could be envy when an acquaintance reveals her pregnancy. Such experiences may be enough to prompt Catherine to make a self-attribution that sticks. Saying, I want another child, she may feel a sense of ease or settledness. More likely, however, her experiences do not prove decisive. Instead of a sense of ease, Catherine might find herself saying, no, that's not it, or still not sure. And then she may find herself simply revisiting the same thoughts and imaginings. Some of Catherine's active self-questioning and prompting permits her to discover further imaginings. For instance, she may notice that her imaginings are all about having a child just like the one she's already got. On noticing this, she might find herself with a fantasy of freezing him in time and hanging on to his childhood. These images will suggest a different desire. It's not really a second child she wants, but this one all over again. She imagines a newborn, imagines its cries, and waking in the night for feelings. These imaginings she finds pleasing to linger over. Given that desires can be complex, tracing their presence in one's thoughts, imaginings, and fantasies can take a lot of reflection and data to reflect upon. The interesting thing is that both Kassam and Lawler think that this is an illustration of how we normally and completely naturally use the empirical stance, or psychological stance on our own mental states. They think that this is an illustration of, this is a refutation of Moran. Contrary to what Moran says, we are not reflecting on the reasons for our attitudes, but we are reflecting on the thoughts and feelings from which we can infer back to these attitudes. So I find that very curious, because in this rather plausible description of psychological reflection, those things are completely mixed. So Laura and Kassam claim this is a Rileyan exercise, yet Catherine considers both reasons for wanting a child and the facts of an already existing attitude of wanting a child. So if you look back this, she finds herself lingering over the memory of how a newborn feels in one's arms. Is this a manifestation of an existing desire? I don't think so. This is a reason for wanting to have someone. If that memory is pleasant, then that's a reason. If you just remember how nice it is to hold a baby, that's a reason to have. It's clearly a reason to have someone else, another one. But then she notes an emotion that could be envy when an acquaintance reveals her pregnancy. That is a manifestation of an existing inclination, right? So that's not clear. That's not a reason for having another child. That's a sign of having another child. Similarly, so saying, I want another child, she may feel a sense of ease or settledness. That's also a manifestation. So with the red ones, that does serve their purposes. The pieces that are highlighted with red are indeed manifestations of existing inclinations or possibly existing desire, but the blue one isn't. There's no way that could be regarded like that. Here is another one from later. She imagines a newborn, imagines its cries and waking in the night for feedings. These imaginings she finds pleasing to linger over. I mean, that probably she's the only one in the history of the universe who finds that pleasant, because I don't think this is a particularly pleasant experience. But maybe it is. I think, again, that's a reason to repeat the experience again, rather than a sign of an existing. Or maybe this is an incredibly complicated piece of psychology and she already wants it, and therefore she's having a cognitive dissonance reduction and trying to forget how unpleasant this was. But I think that complicates things too much. So that's the first comment. And the second comment is that both Kassam and Laura insist that you either have this desire or you don't. But we can just stipulate that in this case, Catherine already has a desire. It's not like she's trying to make up her mind or she's trying to form a desire, or it's not a process of forming a desire. But it is a case when he already either has the desire or not, and all she has to do is to find out which is the case. Now, this is characteristic of the empirical stance. And it's something that does not happen in Morin's deliberative sense, because in a deliberative deliberative stance, finding out whether you have an attitude and forming that attitude cannot always be distinguished, right? Because you're reflecting on the reasons for forming an attitude, if you properly reflect on the reasons, even if you hadn't had the attitude in the first to begin with, at the end of the process, you would have formed the attitude. And that's that is actually the explanation of the success why you have knowledge at the end and why you have privileged knowledge at the end. So you start to deliberate on the question, you go over your reasons, and at the end, you end up with knowing what it is that you have most reason to have. And given that you made a commitment that you will have the attitude that you have most reason to have, this is clearly what you're having. So I'm committed to believe what I have most reason to believe. I go over all the reasons for and against whether eating meat is wrong. I arrive at a conclusion and I say, I found out that I have reasons to believe that eating meat is not wrong. That's what I have most reason to believe. And since I made a commitment that I will believe whatever I have most reason to believe, and that's what it is, I'm believing it. But as I said, in this stance, you can't really distinguish. Maybe you already had that belief, and you just had a kind of rational self-reconstruction. No new mental state or mental attitude is formed. You just kind of replayed the process of forming the attitude to find out whether you have the attitude or not. That's a possibility. But it's also possible that you haven't actually had the attitude at the beginning, and the attitude was formed during this process. Right? So both are possibilities, and the two can't really be separated. Whereas in the empirical sense, at least, you know, in principle, you could start with a case and you already have clearly have the attitude and you're just finding out whether you're having it or not. But I think, and this is what Lawler and Kassam assume about Catherine's case, but I think it's just really not very clear. I think in these cases, so Laura says, given that desires can be complex, tracing their presence in one's thoughts, imaginings, and fantasies can take a lot of reflection and data to reflect upon. It's assumed that the desire is already there. I'm really not sure that that's true. And I'm really not sure that in the complex cases that we are interested in, the process of... So this is another thing that's very important for Moran, that the process of reflection could change the existing landscape. The theoretical stance just meant to be the observer's perspective, right? So I already have the desire or don't have the desire, and then I'm coming to look whether I have it or not. What sometimes Moran calls the spectator's point of view. The spectator is not changing the act. It's not a participant in the action. In contrast, in the agential account, in the deliberative sense, the very process of reflection is changing the landscape that you're investigating. Now, it seems to me that in something like Lawler's example, that's very much happening. After a few days of thinking about it, maybe she had an incipient desire, but I think I predict that her desire will either grow stronger or grow weaker. As she's reflecting on the reasons for and against, as she's reflecting on how she feels on the, about the thought of these possibilities, and her reflections veer in one way or another, by the end, either she will have reaffirmed her desire and thereby her desire grew stronger, or she found that she doesn't, after all, have this desire. For example, in the way that it's hinted, like she just wants her current child to stay a child and not grow up rather than have another child, in which case the desire or the incipient desire would have be significantly weakened or even disappear. So, I think what's happening in these cases is that we do both consider reasons for attitudes and investigate how we already react to these, or whether we have manifestations of these attitudes, and we both occupy the spectator's point of view, and at the same time, with some of these reflections, change the landscape. Now, I want to say that even though that this is most often applied to attitudes like beliefs and desires, it would apply also to a case like emotions. When I mean emotions, it's not just standing emotions, but felt emotions, occurrent felt emotions. Here is a case that I also used in another context from Anna Karenina. So in Anna Karenina, Anna Karenina is a married woman, and a young man called Vronsky falls in love with her and starts to pursue her. And Anna first rejects his advances. She's committed to her husband. She thinks this is all wrong. and then something happens. And here is a sort of moving passage from Anna Karenina when Tolstoy says, "At first, Anna sincerely believed that she was displeased with him for daring to pursue her. Soon after her return from Moscow, on arriving at a soiree where she had expected to meet him and not finding him there, she realized distinctly from the rush of disappointment that she had been deceiving herself. and that this pursuit was not merely not distasteful to her, but that it made the whole interest of her life. So, so what happens here? This is this looks like a classic case of extended Raelianism, right? So she had strong emotions. She used to have strong emotions in Vronsky's presence. She identified as feeling displeased, that being disturbed by Vronsky's advances. She thought that in Vronsky's presence she had these negative experiences of displeasure, annoyance, and she attributed to herself this feeling of not liking him, finding his advances displeasing. And then there is this change of event when there is a rush of disappointment. The rush of disappointment is itself a feeling that she identifies without difficulty, right? She immediately feels the strong disappointment on entering the room and not finding him there. And then that suddenly makes her realize that that feeling, which she previously characterized as displeasure and annoyance, is in fact deep attraction. And it's something that makes the whole interest of her life. Now, I think that one important parameter here is to talk about easy and hard cases. This comes up a little bit in Kassam's book, who says that philosophical theories of self-knowledge should not cover only cases of do I believe that water is red, but also do I believe that eating meat is wrong? I mean, important things that we try to find out about ourselves. But I think most philosophical theories of self-knowledge naturally assume that if we want to give an account, then we don't give a different account for easy cases and for hard cases, right? So if you have acquaintance theory, then if acquaintance is the explanation of how we know our conscious features, then we're acquainted both with Mary seeing red, which is a very, very simple case, but also Anna is acquainted with the conscious feature of whatever it is that she's feeling in Vronsky's presence. The explanation of acquiring knowledge is the same in both cases, which is acquaintance with the conscious feature. Similarly, if Burns' account of simple transparency is right, you know, I ask myself, do I believe that people ask me? That is actually, if I ask myself, do I believe that squirrels apply for mortgages? Then I can't just say directly whether I do or not, because I have to go that's Moran's account. You have to go over the reasons of, I don't think I do. I immediately know that I don't. So most theories naturally think that if you have an account, then it will not distinguish between the complicated and the easy cases. I just said this about acquaintance. So there are easy and difficult cases of attitudes, like I believe it's raining, or I believe that eating meat is wrong. That was an illustration in Anna Karenina's case. So I think there is an easy case here, which is the rush of disappointment. She has a rush of disappointment. It presents itself as disappointment. It's a very intense experience, and that conscious feature is directly presented to you. And she just knows that she feels this disappointment. There is not much more that you need to say about this. But what is much more difficult is to get to know the nature of the feeling that she has prior to her realization about Vronsky in Vronsky's presence. So that's also an emotion. That also has, I think, a characteristic conscious character. But it's not just like it hits you like a sensation of red or a feeling of pain. It's something that's much more difficult to characterize or to understand. So I think that In order to understand something like this, the nature of that emotion, the nature of that conscious feeling, you have to appeal to the same kind of process that Catherine appeals to when trying to find out about a hard case of a desire, a difficult case of desire, whether she wants to have another child. It's, what is it? So if Anna didn't have that moment where the circumstances that Vronsky wasn't at the soiree and she felt this rush of disappointment, which helped her to make a realization and a discovery about herself, if she didn't have that, she could have engaged, if she was a bit more honest with herself, she could have engaged in some self-questioning and ask herself, what is it that I feel in his presence? Is that really annoyance? It's something strong, it's something that affects me strongly, which now seems that it's displeasure, but maybe it isn't. What if, and then she could think about various options, what if I wasn't married and I had the same approaches from Vronsky, how would I feel about that? And then she may find that thought makes her very happy or wistful. So essentially, you could pursue the same the same investigation with respect to conscious emotions as well. Now, what you can't change, of course, in this case, what you can't change is how you felt in the past. Conscious episodes have a duration. They are characterized by a characteristic feeling. And if this is in the past and Anna's meeting with Vronsky it's already in the past and its conscious character is fixed simply because the past is fixed. You can't change that. So in this case, the process of deliberation is not going to change the object of the inquiry in the way that the process of deliberation or reflection changes the object of inquiry in the case of standing attitudes. But I think some of the things will change, and that, for example, Anna's standing emotion towards Vronsky, and a standing emotion will manifest itself in different kinds of conscious emotions. So if the story went differently and the realization didn't come as a result of this one instance when she had a revelation from the rush of disappointment, but rather the realization came from a process of honest self-questioning, when at the end she would have realized that Ronsky's pursuit is the meaning, gives the meaning to her life, then by the end of this, her emotion would have changed. Something would have been similar, but realizing that she was also in love with him would have changed the nature of the emotion and would have definitely changed the nature of the conscious feeling on subsequent occasions. So, I think, I mean, this is something that is, as I said, a very characteristic part of Moran's view, but I think it extends much further than the application of the deliberative stance. So it says, what is left out of the spectator's view is the fact that I not only have a special access to someone's mental life, but that it is mine, expressive of my relation to the world, subject to my evaluation, correction, doubts, and tensions. This will mean that it is to be expected that a person's own awareness of his mental life will make for differences in the constitution of that mental life, differences that do not obtain with respect to one's awareness of other things or other people. For this reason, introspection is not to be thought of as a kind of light cast in a realm of inner objects, leaving them unaltered. So I think this is very true. It's very true even of the cases when we don't follow the uncompromising rationality requirement of the deliberative stance. So the way the debate is constructed at the moment is that you either have the empirical stance when you are treating yourself from the third person point of view, the extended Reilian account. In that case, you're occupying the spectator's point of view, and in that case, your musings don't change the landscape. This is what Kassam and Laura suggest, because they say we are not always that rational. We can't live up to these lofty ideals that Moran is putting us. We are just, you know, ordinary human beings who have to understand our mental life from our actions and reactions. On the other side, you have Moran, who says there is the deliberative stance, and the deliberative stance is the only one where we're not estranged ourselves from ourselves. But here, you have the demand of rationality. You have to be committed to this principle that you will have the attitudes that you have most reason to have. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And only when you're occupying this stance, you will have this phenomenon of the reflection itself changing the underlying landscape. So I think the truth is somehow the mixture of these. You can't separate these two from each other. The spectator view actually seems to work very well for easy cases. I mean, if anything, that seems to me a relevant distinction. In easy cases, I just find myself with, yes, I'm having a sensation of red. Yes, I'm having a rush of disappointment. Yes, I believe that water is red. No need to change the underlying landscape. I could just see that I have these through one or another process. In hard cases, however, the process of reflection will change the landscape, whichever stance we are occupying. So I think everyone is right in this sense. Just a closing thought that I wrote a book many years ago where I argued that privileged accessibility is the mark of the mental. I was very impressed, and I'm still very impressed, by the first three pages of Descartes' second meditation. So the title of the second meditation is On the Nature of the Human Mind, and that it's better known than the body. And I thought, he's right. That is the nature of the human mind, that it is better known than the body. And I followed Descartes on this in the first three pages. He establishes what belongs to the mind and what belongs to the body. And what he uses is the test of the evil demon. He says that I assume that I'm being deceived by the evil demon, and I see what still belongs to me. And then he lists all the mental features, emotions, perceptions, experiences, imaginings, beliefs, cognitions. So I thought that what this test amounted to, really, is to the demon's intervention takes away everything to which we don't have privileged access and keeps only those things which we have privileged access. And this is the recipe for establishing what belongs to the mind. And I was very impressed by this because in those three pages, Descartes abolishes the Aristotelian conception of the soul, and it replaces it with the modern conception of the mind, which we still have today. And only those three pages explain why we don't think that digestion is a mental process, what we think that pain is a mental process. I haven't seen any other cogent explanation for why we carve the mind in this way. In the second part of that book, I argue that given that privileged access is the mark of the mental, externalism cannot be true, for very much the reasons that Paul Boghossian is writing in that paper where the Boghossian transparency is mentioned. So I still kind of think that that all that is right, but some people to whom I told about the book or read parts of the book, they said, okay, so privileged access is the mark of the mental, but what is your account of privileged access? And I said, oh, that's for future work, that, you know, I don't have one, but, you know, in due course, that's all will be worked out. And I've been thinking of that on and off in the last 15 years, and now my conclusion is that all these things amount to privileged access. I think that no one is particularly alone right in this field. I think that self-knowledge is a combination of direct awareness of conscious features, a transparent statement of simple beliefs, observation and self-interpretation of internal promptings, reconstructions of attitudes based on reasons. It all goes in there. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.